Hello and welcome to the first interview of the Land War side of the Falklands series podcast. This series is being recorded for the Phoenix Think Tank and the Centre for International Maritime Security, the PTT in SIMSEC. I'm Alexander Clark. I have the joy of being the host of this series, and this was the first Land Warfare interview. It's with Ian Gardner, who was the company commander of X-Ray Company, X-Ray Company in 4-5 Commando during 1982. He retired from the Royal Marines as a brigadier and has written a book, which is a very good read, called The Yompers, with 45 Commando in the Falklands War, published by Pen and Sword in 2012. Now, this is an interesting interview, and I hope you enjoy it. He has a very interesting and varied life, and it's well worth a listen.
Hola, nuestros amigos. Do you like Sea Control? Do you enjoy the SimSec Next War blog? Become part of the discussion and our community. Sign up for SimSec membership at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and podcasts emailed to you every week, and an account that allows you to submit articles directly to our editors through WordPress. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, but it's nothing without your constant support and engagement. Your ideas keep us going. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
Let's start off with the beginning of the war. Let's start off with the initial experience. What did you think when you were first told you were going out to the Falklands? What went through your head?
Well, I was telephoned at 4 o'clock in the morning on the 2nd of April. I was in bed, of course, the day we're going to go on Easter leave. We were not expecting to go to the Falklands any more than anyone else was expecting to go to the Falklands. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, the telephone operator said, get into barracks now, you're going to war. 2nd of April, is this a late April Fool's joke? No, it's not a joke. Get into barracks now. Elated surprise. Elated in a way because, yes, all the all the uncertainties that faced us were there. But actually, we were a bloody good organization. We knew we had good leaders, we were well trained, we'd just been training doing winter warfare training. Most of us were ski, mountain and Arctic warfare trained. I'd been command of my company for some 3 months by now. I had commanded a company before in Oman. I had every confidence in my people. This was going to be good fun. In addition, I think you have to remember that the Royal Marines always were an endangered species. And the Cold War was pretty chilly in 1982. And, the British Army, the Rhine, the armoured warfare in Germany, that was where the real action was. That's where careers were made. Some careers were made in Northern Ireland, but mostly in Germany. And we really had no place in Germany. We'd cut out a role in the Arctic, sure, and in amphibious warfare. But, you know, that was increasingly under the hammer from the politicians. And, in fact, I now know from papers I've read in the Ministry of Defence that the Royal Marines almost certainly would have been disbanded in a few years, probably by 1984-85. The amphibious shipping upon which we depended, our principal raison d'etre, was amphibious warfare. The amphibious ships were going. The helicopter ships, the aircraft carriers were going, and due to be sold to Australia. The next thing was going to be us. We knew that. And yet here, suddenly, having been at the bottom of the food chain, everybody is looking in our direction. And you have to be a complete kind of idiot not to sense that. We sense that very clearly. Aha! Got you! That'll learn you to ignore all the multiple capabilities that we've been trying to offer over the years, and you've been focusing in on this narrow laser nonsense in Germany. Wider military virtues, which we tried to embody and capture. Now you're coming to ask for us to help. Well, we're coming. We'll do it, for sure. So, yes, there were threats. Yes, it was spooky being called to war from one's bed. Time has not found ways. And one of the ways that we were lucky was we had this time. Other units didn't have the time. They were told to attack objectives which they didn't have time to shape or to even to conduct proper reconnaissance of. We had both. And so before the Battle of the Two Sisters, we had sent two or three patrols in there to shape the attitudes of the people who were there, kill them in their sleeping bags, explain to them at the end of a machine gun that this is what's going to happen to you when we come in strength, firing artillery, DFs onto them, and finding out where their place is, where their strengths and weaknesses were. So we had a fairly clear idea by the time we went in what the position was like. Our intelligence was pretty good. So I didn't go on those patrols, although I obviously helped to plan them and helped to brief them and debrief them. So I'm not the person to talk about that. However, the battle itself, commanding officer gave his orders. He invited us into his brain and we brainstormed it. He too was an arch exponent of Mission Command, Colonel Andrew Whitehead, brilliant. And by the end of this exercise, we had the clearest possible impression of what it was he was trying to achieve and why, what the brigade commander was trying to achieve and why, all the constraints, all the priorities, all the what-ifs. And what-ifs, for instance, what would we do if we went through them like a knife through butter? Then we'd go on and capture Mount Tumbledown the same night. What would we do if I got stuck? What would we do if he got stuck? And so on. So all these what-ifs we had discussed. And had he been killed during the course of the battle, I could have taken over from him seamlessly because I knew what he was trying to do. There were no secrets between us. And this process went right through down through the whole command there, and I made quite sure that every single man in my company, and my company was now about 150 strong, because I had 40 commanders, anti-tank troop attached to me, with Milan missiles. I made sure every single man in my company knew precisely what I knew and what the commanding officer knew, so that he could take decisions using his brains and initiative when presented with the unforeseen. The plan was pretty simple. It didn't really, the ground didn't allow for much else. It was, these two sisters are like two dinosaurs' backs, two dragon backs, parallel to each other, about 1,000 yards apart, each about 1,000 feet high, one further west than the other. My objective was the westernmost of the two sisters, in order that the commanding officer could take the other two companies and capture the easternmost of the two sisters. Two consecutive battles, in fact. Night battle, had to be a night battle because they simply didn't have enough artillery to sustain a day battle because the Chinooks had only managed to, well, you know the story about the Chinooks and Atlantic Conveyor. A silent night battle to go noisy on contact with the enemy. Decisions, well, I obviously had to make my plans and do all the time and space calculations and troops to task. I calculated that it's the journey from the patrol base to the objective. Indeed, I didn't just calculate it. I sent a reconnaissance team to go and time it. A journey which could be done in 2 hours, perhaps three, so I allowed 4 hours for that journey. Well, of course, that's the first thing that went wrong. No plan survives first contact with the enemy. Mine didn't even survive that long because the mist came down as soon as we left our patrol base and my navigating team, and therefore me, I'm responsible. You can't just blame them. I was navigating too. We probably were 1 or 2 degrees out and we found ourselves the wrong side of a massive stone run. I don't know if you've seen those stone runs, but these are great rivers of boulders, the like of which I've never seen anywhere else. Some stones as big as mini cars, you stand on them, they move at night, they're slippery, they're wet. 150 men trying to cross these things, carrying each about 80 pounds, 100 pounds. You can imagine how much that delayed us. Well, the journey which could have been done, I planned for 4, took 6 hours. It was a nightmare journey. The company kept on being split up, kept on trying to go back and find people. Like one man who fell over a very steep bank with all his kit and was knocked unconscious. Another man, one of my signalers, started vomiting and puking at the same time. I had to leave him behind. And I couldn't call up on the radio and tell my commanding officer that we were late, because if I did, I would immediately give away what we were doing. There was no secure radio, and they would hear me, and they would get a direction finding on me and probably bring an artillery barrage in on me. And I was, by the end of this period, I was getting, my nerves were in shreds. And eventually, at the last minute, I called my commanding officer and explained to him what had happened. And instead of chewing my head off over the radio, he understood completely what had happened. And he said, okay, we'll change the plan. I will take the ship's artillery, I will take the other artillery, you have the anti-tank weapons, you've got exclusive use of the mortars. We will go, sort yourself out, tell me when you're ready, and instead of two consecutive battles, we'll make it two concurrent battles, we'll crack on. And this act of trust, this act of patience, was enough to soothe my rattled nerves. And I was able to turn around and pass this confidence and this trust on to my people and say, okay, guys, put the last six nightmare hours behind you. Sort yourselves out. Tell me when you're ready and we'll crack on. And 10 minutes later, 150 knackered Marines were as good as new. We assumed there was a minefield at the bottom of the hill. We'd never found any minefields, and we'd never seen any evidence of minefields on our sister in our reconnaissance, but we assumed there were minefields there, and so we were all ready just to crack straight over. If someone went up on a mine, you have to leave them and crack on. Don't wait to attend to people. Someone behind can do that. It's pretty brutal, I know, but that's the nature of a conventional battle. I mean, we did go to some trouble to point out to people, this is not a guerrilla war. This is not the sort of wars that we've been involved in Oman and Borneo and Brunei, where if someone goes down as a casualty, everybody then devotes themselves to carrying the casualty, treating the casualty. You can't do this in this sort of battle. Someone goes down, leave him. Stick his rifle in the ground, leave him. Mark him and leave him and crack on. Let someone else sweep up behind and do the casualty treating and so on. And we impress that on our people. So we advanced. We had to cross 1,000 meters of open ground. By now, of course, I mean, the weather is extremely changeable down there. Having been so misty that we got lost, now it was a bright moonlit night. We had to cross 1,000 meters of open ground to get into the rocks. My first troop commander went across, and I watched him crossing that ground with my heart in my mouth. But he got across, and he was my second. Well, I went off soon after he got across, and my second troop came off. Then can't remember exactly the order of march, but I was very rarely more than about 200, 300 meters behind the leading troop. And in the battle itself, I was much closer than that, from our tactical headquarters. I knew that once we'd got into the rocks, we would win. I was scared as hell crossing that open ground. There they could massacre us. There they could machine gun us with half-inch Brownings and their artillery. And we could be pinned down there and just mown away bit by bit. Once in the rocks, we could do something. We would win a gutter fight in the dark. They had half-inch Brownings, we knew that. The first fire was half-inch Browning. I recognized it immediately. I used half-inch Browning in Oman, and as soon as I heard it, my heart sunk. Oh, God, I recognize that sound. We're going to be at the other end of it this time. However, by the time they opened up on us, we were in the rocks, and it was... They were never going to be able to use their machine guns to full effect once we were in the rocks. My lead troop advanced up two sisters unopposed until about halfway up, maybe even two-thirds of the way up. I think I believe now that our original patrols into the rocks had discouraged them from holding the lower rocks in strength. I think that was a mistake on their part, or maybe they weren't well enough trained to conduct the sort of operations, the withdrawal operations that would have been necessary to really cut us up in the lower rocks. Anyhow, my lead troop found that it was unopposed, and so went on to attack the higher objective, the higher part of the rock, where they were opposed, of course. And whereas the bottom half of the rocks were undefended, the top part of the rocks were defended very stoutly indeed. Of course, the lead troop was now attacking an objective which wasn't its objective, but that didn't matter. I mean, this is mission command, crack on, you know, time is of the essence. We had HMS Glamorgan firing in from the sea. We knew there was a land-based Exocet, which was waiting to pluck off plums like her, but it only had a daylight firing capability. So as long as it was dark, we still had Glamorgan giving us artillery fire. But if we were still fighting in daylight, we could forget any help from the ship. She had to go. Incidentally, throughout the entire battle, not a single artillery round was fired in support of my sister, of my battle. About 1,000 rounds were fired overall in support of 4-5 Commando that night. Not a single one was fired in support of X-ray Company. They were all fired on the other sister. We did have mortars, and we did have 40 Commando's Milan anti-tank weapons, and those proved to be brilliant weapons. And we used those to excellent effect. However, we now had a battle on the top third, I suppose, of the mountain. At the extreme range of 40 Commando's Milan, about 2,000 metres, firing an anti-tank weapon 2,000 metres at the extremity of the range, which had, with no night sights, by the way, was an interesting exercise. We used imaginative use of torches and tracer. We were firing over our heads, of course, or they were firing over our heads. Having a Milan missile fired over your head when you're about 100 metres from the target was an interesting exercise too. It's funny watching it coming towards you. It's a strange sort of farting, fluffing, spluttering noise it makes. When it goes over your head with a great whoosh and suddenly, boom, this massive shattering bang about 100 yards in front of you. I'm very glad I wasn't at the receiving end of that. But that was a lifesaver. That and the mortars, although mortars had great problems too. I had a mortar fire controller, Corporal Foster was my mortar fire controller. He was stuck with me, right next to me the whole time. We tried to agree a grid reference of the enemy to fire mortars. We agreed that it was so close we might as well give our own grid reference. That's that. At least we knew what our own grid reference was. And that's what we did. And I shouted to anybody who could hear, 8 mortar rounds coming in, count the rounds, when you get to 8, go. And that's what we did. You call it a blue on blue, yeah, okay, we mortared ourselves, but at least we did it deliberately. Unlike previous occasions in my life when I've done it accidentally. So the mortars were very helpful, very good, although they had problems too because of the boggy ground. No matter what they did, and they'd done everything they could. They'd put sandbags, they'd put rocks underneath the base plates to try and build a foundation, but the ground was so boggy that the base plates kept on disappearing into the bog, and they kept on having to dig them out. So we didn't have the full weight of mortar fire that we would have liked, but we did have some mortar fire, and it did make a difference. It was very helpful. But the battle winner, as far as I'm concerned, was these anti-tank weapons. Both our handheld anti-tank weapons and our 40 Commando's Milan anti-tank weapons. And the initiative, the courage, and the fighting qualities of the Marines, of course. Lance corporals, Marines, second lieutenants, knowing what we were trying to achieve, seeing what was facing in front of them, taking decisions, supporting each other, pepper potting. I don't know if you know the term pepper potting. Fire and movement. Fire and movement. One group firing, the other group moving, then swapping. Down you go, it's fire movement, constantly exchanging positions by fire and movement, moving forward. We did that. I don't know how many other units did that, but that's what we did. And that's what my Marines did. Covering each other, throwing a grenade over, someone else came around. Like fighting in a built-up area, almost. The rocks were so big. Of course, we were now under artillery fire from the other side, and we came across casualties from the other side, even bits of casualties. When you're diving into a mud hole and you find bits of human being in there before you, yeah, it's pretty messy. But my Marines, over the next 4 or 5 hours, fought their way bit by bit up this mountain against machine gun fire, anti-tank weapons, artillery fire, grenades, rifles, until eventually, in a snowstorm in the mist, in the dark, they cleared the top of the hill of the Queen's enemies at the point of the bayonet. In spite of what technology has done to change the nature of the battlefield, men still have to fight with clubs and pointed sticks, and that's what we did. We were now under artillery fire, of course. why the Argentines did that? We were expecting to be counterattacked. One's always expecting to be counterattacked. That's our doctrine. You always try and counterattack. The Argentines, I don't think, were well enough trained to do a counterattack, but we didn't really know that at the time. But they fired intermittent artillery at us over the next 36 hours, and it was big stuff, 155mm. It's not pleasant being artilleryed. It's the loudest noise I've ever heard. I thought my eardrums were going to meet inside my head. sometimes they came so close that I was deaf for 20 minutes, half an hour. I thought my eardrums had burst on one occasion. But the Marines got pretty good at this. They even managed to make fun of this. An artillery shell, when it's coming your way, whistles. The further away it's going to land, the longer it whistles. If it's coming close, it's a short whistle. And if it's going to land on your head, well, you don't hear it until after you're dead. We have made a bit of a study of this, and of course we don't want to crap in your little trench there or in your dugout, so Marines would nip out when they thought there was an interlude and drop their drawers and do the biz out in the open ground. Being watched by their mates, who'd wait until the most vulnerable moment and then go, war is a game to be played with a smiling face. And at the end of it, the elation. I cannot begin to describe the elation at having won a battle. I must point out that I had lost people in Oman. I had people killed under my command in Oman. Sometimes, I mean, there's no commander who is immune to the notion that had he done it differently, he might not have lost those people. It's something which you just can't escape. You can't allow it to consume you, and you process these thoughts, and it doesn't bother you in the long run. But you're not immune to that thought. And I certainly believe I lost people in Oman. Had I done it differently, I might not have lost those people. Of course, you could equally well say I might well have lost more people. But there you are. Here I won this battle, a night fight, up a 1,000-foot mountain, and I had one man wounded. I'd lost no dead in this battle. The other two companies lost 4 dead. They were very unlucky. They were hit with machine gun or artillery fire. But to win a battle up a 1,000-foot mountain at night, and to come home with the same number of live Marines that I've taken, no winner of an Olympic gold medal, no captain of a Grand Slam team or a World Cup winner can begin to understand the elation that you feel. No cameras, of course, and no lights except the light of your flares and your artillery shells. But barely a day has passed since then without a humble, grateful thought. That said, we knew we were going to have to repeat the performance 2 nights later on Sapper Hill. And so we subsequently planned the battle for Sapper Hill, and we started advancing to attack Sapper Hill. So we went through the intellectual, moral, spiritual process of preparing ourselves for the second battle. You know, fighting one battle is bad enough. But then preparing yourself to fight the second battle, I've heard it, actually it was David Cooper, the chaplain of Tupara, who said very graphically that to fight a second battle is like asking a man who's had a severe electric shock to stick his finger into the points and switch it on again. And that was a bit like that for us. And so we advanced on Sapper Hill to capture that, but before we got there, it had already been taken by a company of 40 commandos. Then it had been occupied subsequently by the Welsh Guards. 40 commandos took Sapper Hill. It was actually a company attached to the Welsh Guards. So you could say the Welsh Guards took Sapper Hill, but it was the 40 commando company that actually captured it.
Can you just... I'm still getting my head around this. Around the fact that you had 40 commandos, Milan unit attached to your company in 4-5 commando.
Correct.
How did that happen? Was it one of those things that happens in war, a sort of accident, or had it been specifically, you're going to need the extra firepower, so here, have this unit's Milan unit?
Brigadier Julian Thompson needed a very, very reliable, solid unit protecting his base. He chose 40 Commando to do that. 40 Commando never forgave him for excluding them from the fight, but I understand exactly why he did it. I mean, I never asked him why he did it, but if I were him, I would want one of my best units guarding my rear. There was always a possibility of some coup de main on the logistics base, either from West Falkland or directly from the Argentines. And so 40 Commando was chosen to do that. However, it was assessed that 40 Commando's anti-tank weapons were not what was the most important that was required. They didn't need their anti-tank weapons. There wasn't an anti-tank threat. We also lost, I think we lost our entire stock of anti-tank missiles in the bombing at Ajax Bay. We were bombed at Ajax Bay too. Five Marines were killed and about a dozen wounded. And in the course of that, our anti-tank weapons went up in smoke. So we had no anti-tank weapons. So 40 Commando's anti-tank troop with their weapons was detached to 4-5 Commando for the Battle of the Two Sisters. I'm very grateful I am for them to them too. 40 Commando, company attached to the Welsh Guards. Well, the Welsh Guards had taken a hammering in Galahad, of course, and Tristan. I believe it was probably assessed that the threat of an attack on our base, a coup de main attack on our base, had reduced to the point where they could afford to detach a rifle company of 40 Commando. And 40 Commando was beefed up again. Detach a company of 40 Commando to the Welsh Guards. And I think that was an absolutely logical decision to give the Welsh Guards some of the firepower that they'd lost by the attack on the two ships. I mean, you're always looking to, you're always adjusting, cutting and pasting your units to meet the changing circumstances. And for me, that was a perfectly logical one to take. Not that I had any part in it, looking at it from the outside. Though.
So, the advance on Stanley, the final part of it. What was that like? Because, you know, as you said, you've been preparing for this battle, then didn't need it. And then you're advancing on Stanley after that, and, well, that can't have been, that must have been quite a tense situation, because whilst peace had theoretically there had been some sort of surrendering and agreement, you couldn't be quite sure with the Argentinians that they were all on the same hymn sheet.
That's quite true. We advanced up Sapper Hill unopposed, as I say. The Welsh Guard and 40 Commando in particular of Charlie Company of 40 Commander, commanded by Andy Piller, a batchmate of mine and a good friend. We met on top of Sapper Hill. We spent the night on Sapper Hill. Now, without our sleeping bags, without our rucksacks, minus 5, with a wind of about 15 miles an hour, the bitterest, coldest night I've ever known in my life, I tell you. Other units went into Port Stanley. Brigadier Julian Thompson, I believe, quite rightly felt he wanted a tactical unit poised to fight outside of Stanley. We were left on Sapper Hill that night and the following night, but the following night our rucksacks finally reached us, and so we had quite a comfortable night, while others went into Stanley. We didn't go into Stanley until Julian Thompson was satisfied that it was a low-risk move to take fighting units off the tactical ground outside the town. So we were left on tactical ground outside the town until he was satisfied that he didn't need to maneuver his way around Stanley, and we could go into Stanley on an administrative basis. That was 2 days later, of course. We were fairly confident that we weren't going to have to fight for Stanley at that stage. There were so many people in Stanley. We heard that the Argentines we'd seen them streaming away towards the airport. So it wasn't a very tense moment, not really, although it was quite an endurance test that first night. I was worried people are going to die of hypothermia. But not a chance. Marines are like puppies. They're great adapters. They all cuddled and huddled together in the holes in the ground and kept their body heats up. As cold as I was, Marine Birch and the Sergeant Major didn't look so attractive that I wanted to cuddle with them, so I spent my night stamping around the place, gossiping and smoking cigarettes, checking on people that hadn't died of cold.
I suppose a final question that's been sort of thinking. Any lessons from the Falklands War that you would like to pass on to sort of the future? Anything you think that has to be learnt and remembered of the Falklands?
Well, there are a thousand lessons, of course, and I hope I've highlighted most of them in my talk so far. I think the most powerful abiding lesson of all is the one I have mentioned before. It is, war is about surprise. War is chaos. No plan survives first contact with the enemy. Beware of trying to plan too much before a battle in order to avoid taking decisions during it. It's about, I guess, 40, 50%, 60% maybe planning, 40%, 50% flying by the seat of your pants. It's the what ifs, and it's training your people to take decisions in support of your instinct. You can't do it all. As I said before, I didn't win the battle for Two Sisters. The battle was won because I was part of machinery that got my Marines to the right place at the right time, approximately, with the right kit, mentally, physically, intellectually, spiritually capable of doing the duty and making decisions. I played my part in that process. But those decisions had to be taken by them. Ultimately, success or failure, defeat or victory, life or death, rests on 10,000 decisions taken at the lowest paid level in your organization. And unless you have equipped, empowered, informed, trained, inspired, built your people to take those decisions, you've given to those people so that they can take those decisions, those decisions will not be taken and you will fail. You as a leader are there to give for them. You're there to help them do their jobs better. You are there for them, not the other way round. And if that lesson can be remembered and can be applied, then this will not have been a waste of time.
It's all excellent. And thank you very much for taking part.
Not at all.